It's 3 o'clock and you're listening to KTOO News Juneau. I'm Kayla DeRoche, your host for Juneau Afternoon. We'll talk about Michelle Ridgway and her Wildlife Wednesday presentation. Philip Crowder will be here to highlight this weekend's Nutcracker performances. Tonight's World Affairs Council speaker, Dr. Aaron Wolf, will drop by, and Peter Metcalf will talk about his new book on the Alaska Native Brotherhood. We'll also profile the band Susu and the Prophets. And Christy Chamber will tell us about Saturday's holiday radio auction. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more on KTOO News Juneau. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Vice President Joe Biden gave opening remarks to tribal leaders this morning in Washington, D.C. Biden talked about the years-long work it took to pass the Violence Against Women Act. He also discussed new provisions for tribes.
We took a big step forward toward protecting those rights when the President signed the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization into law last year. But there's more to do. And starting on March the 7th of next year, tribal governments will have the power to investigate, prosecute, convict, and sentence non-Native Americans who assault their wives and girlfriends on tribal land. You know, it's not within my power. I apologize for taking so long, so many women damaged in the meantime.
Biden says the administration is determined to help tribes secure resources to put the law into effect, including by calling on Congress to act on a pledge of $25 million in tribal grants authorized under the law. He also stressed to tribes to work with the Department of Justice on implementation. The conference is an opportunity for attendees to interact directly with the Obama administration. Cabinet secretaries say there have been achievements and point to the Cobell settlement. They also touted Obama's summer trip to the Standing Rock Reservation. Officials talked about challenges in education and climate change. This year, there's a focus on young people, which includes 36 White House ambassadors. Obama will also announce an initiative, which includes a youth listening tour and gathering. He will give remarks during the closing session. Now we turn to politics in Alaska. This week, Bill Walker and Byron Mallott were sworn in as governor and lieutenant governor. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, members of Juneau's Native community celebrated the new leaders at a public reception.
Richard Peterson is president of the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. During the reception's opening remarks, Peterson said it was an honor to be part of Walker and Mallott's 250-person transition team.
Usually we're always the minority everywhere we go, and it was just really heartwarming to look around and see so many Native leaders in roles of expertise. Our input, our opinions mattered, and it's hard not to get emotional about that.
Originally, Walker and Mallott, both Alaska-born, campaigned separately, each running for the governor's seat.
What a reflection that was, that you two were able to put egos aside for our state and choose to work together for a unity ticket. And whether you're Democrat or Republican, it feels like we finally have Alaskans fighting for Alaskans. So, geez, howa.
The Mount St. Elias Dancers of Yakutat danced at the inauguration and the reception. Mallott is originally from Yakutat. The group's J.P. Buller said many of them are in Mallott's family, either part of his clan or married into it.
I'd just like to tell you, Byron, how proud we are of you, how much we love you. You represent us so well. We admire you, and we hope to have your integrity, your values, and your constitution to stick with us. Your inspiration to see what some determination and hard work can do.
During one of the last songs, Mallott danced with the group wearing a custom Native unity vest identical to Walker's. For National Native News, I'm Lisa Fu in Juneau.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Striking Eagle Invitational Basketball Tournament and Educational Fair on December 31st. Information on services and the fair at ahcnm.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're back with Juneau Afternoon and Kayla DeRoche. And the weather for tonight is decreasing clouds, patchy fog, and lows 25 to 31. And you're with Michelle Ridgway and Patricia Wary. Michelle Ridgway is going to be doing a Wildlife Wednesday presentation. And Patricia Wary is from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. Welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
So, Patricia, can you tell me about the guest speakers who usually appear for the wildlife presentations?
Well, our presentations for this chapter of Alaska Wildlife Alliance run September through April, and we hunt for people, usually scientists in the community, who can talk about different either habitat that directly affect creatures or the creatures themselves.
Wow, okay. And Michelle, can you tell me about what your talk will be about?
I was asked to present some highlights of creatures in Auk Bay, our own local marine ecosystem for people that live in the vicinity of Auk Bay. So I'll be speaking about just some of the creatures that may not be visible to people that might go to the intertidal zone, that don't venture further into the water. Be mostly highlighting some of my favorite invertebrates. There are many vertebrates, many fishes and marine mammals and birds in Auk Bay. But as we like to say, that the ocean is largely spineless, and that the food web is built on those creatures that have no spine, or the invertebrates. So I'll speak about tiny creatures, small jellyfishes, to some of the more colorful species that live deeper in Auk Bay.
And can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background?
I'm a marine ecologist from Ketchikan. I worked with the Department of Fish and Game in Prince of Wales Island, and before I moved to Juneau in 1988 to work with the university, studying kelp bed ecology at that time. And since then, I've deepened my love for and expertise in researching deeper ecosystems, largely in the Bering Sea.
Okay, and how deep are they? Can you tell me more about that?
Well, Alaska deep waters certainly extend quite deep, over 8,000 meters in the Aleutian Trench, and none of us have been there yet. I mostly work in the Bering Sea, which is up to about 4,000 meters deep, and thus far, with the tools we have, typically, we can do meaningful studies to about 2,000 meters.
Wow. And what kind of animals do you find in such a deep area in the sea?
Well, in the Bering Sea depths, certainly there are vast aggregations of invertebrates like squid that are critical in the food web out in those areas. But in places much more shallow that we'll be speaking about this evening, like Auk Bay, we have smaller invertebrates, crustaceans, mysids and krill, copepods, tiny creatures that most people may not know lie beneath the water, that in some cases people in Auk Bay have lived on for most of their lives.
What's a copepod? I'd like to know about that.
Copepods are tiny crustacean plankton. They're a key zooplankton in the food web, both here in Auk Bay and throughout Alaska.
And how do you study them if their natural environment is so deep in the sea? Do you bring them back with you?
Well, copepods, for example, are quite tiny, and we study them with a variety of tools, plankton nets for collecting, or if we're fortunate enough to have in situ tools where we can study them in their natural habitat, we use macro lenses and other means to quantify them, collect them, bring them back to the lab to study various aspects of their anatomy, physiology, and life history, as well as the energy that they carry and distribute throughout the oceans.
Can you tell me more about that energy?
Well, copepods are among the group of creatures, the assemblage of zooplankton that feed on plant plankton or phytoplankton, and they aggregate energy, which originates with photosynthesis, of course. Phytoplankton photosynthesize, generating energy from sunlight and nutrients. And upon consumption, that is aggregated or stored by copepods in the form of oils, if you will, primarily. And they're so abundant, and copepods, for example, move tremendous distances despite their size. They're moving vertically in the water column. They undergo what's called diurnal migration. So they're moving up toward the sunlight and down to depth to either hide or prey. But they're moving around the volume of the water, such that their oil or that energy that originated up in the shallow surface layers near the sunlit surface layers is then distributed throughout the depths of the sea.
Okay, and you said before that you could go and observe them in their natural environment. So what tools or what transportation would you need for that?
Well, for example, here in Auk Bay, we can use ROVs and in the near future, hope to use submersibles as well, configured with special lighting systems and macro lenses to enhance your ability to actually see these smaller creatures, which are 1 to 2 millimeters in size.
And does any of that mean a submarine?
Oh, yes, ideally. In fact, this evening I'll be speaking about species that are largely within scuba diving depths, talking about creatures that many divers have already seen because Auk Bay is relatively shallow. But there are some parts of Auk Bay that we haven't seen in, and observed in detail. And for that reason, this March, I'll be bringing a submersible to the bay, a small single-person submarine that will allow me to, more time to actually study the behavior and interactions of species at depth right there in our little bay.
Can you give an idea of how big this submarine is?
Oh, large is not a term we use for these subs. This is a smaller a sub, let's say, visualize a VW Bug.
All right. Yeah. And for those listeners interested, could you tell us how we could go see you tonight?
Short presentation about small creatures in Auk Bay is going to be this evening at the Thunder Mountain High School Library, beginning at 7 p.m.
And Patricia, can you tell me what you think will be the most interesting aspect of going to see this talk?
Oh, I can't show you, but I can tell you I'm holding up one for photos, and this is in a magnification, I assume, here in my hand. I'd say it looks fiery reds and oranges. They'll see some beautiful things that they won't have, most people, I wouldn't have the opportunity to see.
Okay. And before we close up the interview, can you tell me what that creature is?
What I have here is a photograph of Dairona, and this was actually taken by one of Juno's premier undersea photographers, Art Such. And Dairona is one of the nudibranch or naked gilled creatures. They're common name is sea slugs, but as you can see, they don't look very slug-like.
No.
They're actually incredibly elegant, and their life histories are rather fascinating, and the fact that they live and breed and raise their young in Auk Bay beyond most people's view, but right in front of their homes is one of the things I'll be sharing tonight.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. That was great. Well, you can see Michelle Ridgway and her Wildlife Wednesday presentation tonight, and I hope you go.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 3rd of December, 2014. It was on this day, 1947, that Tennessee Williams' play, A Streetcar Named Desire, opened on Broadway. He'd started writing it 3 years before during the rehearsals of his first play, The Glass Menagerie. And when The Glass Menagerie opened, it was a big success, and suddenly he was famous at the age of 34. He finished the play February 1947. He wanted the director, Elia Kazan, to direct it, but Kazan read the script. He was not interested. But Kazan's wife, Molly, read the script, loved it, finally convinced her husband to take it on. Kazan negotiated a great deal for himself. He got star billing and a 20% take of the profits, and he got to do most of the casting for the play. He cast Jessica Tandy as Blanche. He'd seen her in a one-act play in Los Angeles. And for the role of Stanley Kowalski, they decided on a famous leading man, John Garfield. But he was too difficult in negotiations, and Kazan thought about a young, unknown actor named Marlon Brando, who'd played a supporting role in a play that Kazan directed called Truckline Cafe, which was a flop, but Brando, 21 at the time, played his part so well that the audience would often stamp their feet and scream after his big speech. Kazan sent Brando up to Provincetown, where Tennessee Williams was living. He gave him $20 for bus fare, and it took Brando 3 days to get there because he decided to hitchhike and save the $20 to buy food. He did some plumbing and some wiring on Tennessee Williams' home in Provincetown and then gave a reading of the role. And Williams was ecstatic, and Brando was cast as Stanley. On opening night, when the curtain went down, the audience stood and applauded for 30 minutes. The producer, Irene Selznick, said, "That night was the first time I ever saw an audience on Broadway get to its feet." The play ran for more than 850 performances. Here's a poem for today by Galway Connell entitled Wait. Wait for now. Distrust everything if you have to, but trust the hours. Haven't they carried you everywhere up to now? Personal events will become interesting again. Hair will become interesting. Pain will become interesting. Buds that open out of season will become interesting. Second-hand gloves will become lovely again. Their memories are what give them the need for other hands. And the desolation of lovers is the same, that enormous emptiness carved out of such tiny beings as we are asks to be filled. The need for the new love is faithfulness to the old. Wait. Don't go too early. You're tired. But everyone's tired. But no one is tired enough. Only wait and listen. Music of hair, music of pain, music of looms weaving all our loves again. Be there to hear it. It will be the only time, most of all, to hear the flute of your whole existence, rehearsed by the sorrows, play itself into total exhaustion. A poem by Galway Connell entitled Wait from his selected poems, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Kayla DeRoche, and I'm here with Philip Crowder and Charlotte Truitt.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
So can you introduce yourself?
I'm Charlotte Truitt, and I'm the school administrator of Juno Dance Theater.
And I'm Philip Crowder. I'm the artistic director and executive director of Juno Dance Theater.
Okay, and I understand there's a Nutcracker.
Yes, it's that time of the year, wondrous time of the year, when we'll be presenting our annual Nutcracker Ballet at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium. And the dates for that are Friday, December 5th at 7 p.m., Saturday, December 6th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., so there's two shows on Saturday, and then a Sunday matinee, December 7th at 2 p.m. And so we have a total of four shows that we're offering to the community, and we do this every year. I think, what is this? We're talking, we think this is our ninth year here of doing, the Nutcracker, and I'm the choreographer. And every year I try to make it a little bit different. You know, I try to make it more exciting. I'll change the choreography. I bring in guest artists. We always have new costumes. There's always something. We always try to make it a little bit more interesting for people who come see it every year. And this year, speaking of guest artists, this year we have a Matthew Prescott, a professional dancer from New York City. He used to dance at the Joffrey Ballet in Chicago, and he's a Broadway dancer. I think he was working, last show he did was a Phantom of the Opera, and also he was also worked as a dance coach for Billy Elliot, I do believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big Broadway show that's real popular in New York. And he's a very well-established choreographer and professional dancer, and he's going to be our guest artist here, dancing the role of Cavalier with our own Gabrielle Duvernay, one of our JDT students, one of our advanced students. And this will be her second year of doing the Sugar Plum Fairy. So we really look forward to having him here to dance with Gabrielle, and it's going to be a wonderful show, and I hope everybody comes out to see it.
Yeah, definitely. And can you tell me a little bit about the age group of your students and your dancers?
Well, at JDT, we have classes in creative movement that starts at about age 3 and 4, and we have classes that go all the way up to through adults with modern as well. And there'll be some new offerings next semester of Zumba and modern for adults. And as Philip said, the base of our program is classical ballet training, and we're very proud of our classes and our students and the good work they do. Lots of good training happening from very young, and then even some of our students move on, and then the older advanced students can train the young ones as well under Mr. Crowder's supervision. And it's a good training ground for young people to get involved. We have almost 200 students. And in the Nutcracker production, we start like at age 8, and they go on up through the high school years, and there's lots of roles. We have over 70 in our cast, and that includes even, I guess, the baby mice are 6 and 7 year olds too. So you get the cute little dancers, and then all the way up through the dancers who are quite advanced, doing very serious classical ballet choreography, and it is just beautiful. It's a delightful family affair, and we have a really something for everyone to enjoy about the Nutcracker. Such a great story with lots of characters, lots of exciting paced movement, and it's a wonderful holiday tradition.
Yes, and again, you know, the Nutcracker Ballet is traditionally used as a vehicle, really, to help train dancers in schools like ours. You know, it's part of our programming where the dancers come up over the years, as they get older and more advanced, they get harder roles. They start to go on point. They just start doing point work and variations that are in the Nutcracker. So I've always thought of the Nutcracker as a vehicle for training our students. And the extra benefit of that also is we're able to offer that to the Juno community. You know, all the people out there who love dance, you know, can come see the Nutcracker and be entertained. And it also trains our dancers. And we have some really wonderful dancers in our school. A lot of our older dancers go off for the summer. Many of them go off to very, very prestigious schools during the summer to train. For example, Boston Ballet School, Boston Conservatory, American Ballet Theater, the Bolshoi Ballet School in New York. And also we have students also over in Moscow right now training with the Bolshoi, one of our ex-students. And also Milwaukee Ballet, in the past also the Joffrey Ballet. I mean, they just go all over the place. We have a student who's in Marymount College in Manhattan right now, going to college. And so we're very proud of our students and their achievements. And we believe our program is a very strong program, and it offers really excellent dance training.
And so what's the average age for a ballet dancer? Like, when do they usually reach the height of their professionalism?
Well, it's like a lot of things nowadays, like a gymnast. You know, you see younger and younger kids, you know, going to the Olympics and stuff. And so by the time a kid is about the age of 14, 15, 16, that's when they have to kind of decide whether they want to commit themselves to trying to be a dancer, you know, the kind of intense training it takes and dedication, you know, day after day after day. To do that. And most dancing careers, it depends on the individual, whether you have injuries, you know, in your individual physique and desire. But most dancers go into their 40s, early 40s, and then they retire. In my particular case, I stopped dancing on stage when I was like 42 years old. And I still do, you know, some character dancing. I was like, I'm going to be doing Drosselmeyer and the Nutcracker, but that's acting. You know, character role. So that's something I can still do in my old age. But most ballet dancers go into their early 40s and then they retire. They become teachers, choreographers. There's different aspects of the theater they can go into. So it's a short career. You know, I've always thought that it was funny that just right when you really get to where you really know what you're doing and you really understand what you're doing, you have to stop. You know, so that's one of those kind of careers.
Yeah. And you said that you have a role in the Nutcracker. Are you speaking at all?
No. It's all nonverbal. It's Drosselmeyer. It's all pantomime. You know, ballet pantomime and acting. It's not the kind of acting that you know we think of as you know with dialogue. It's all pantomime. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about choreographing these different dance moves for the music that you set up?
Right. It's funny because when the Nutcracker first came out, I can't remember the exact date. It was late 1800s when Tchaikovsky first wrote that, and it was done in Russia, and it wasn't very popular at the time. The music itself became very popular in of itself. Symphonies would play it, and it wasn't until really a Nutcracker came to America that it really came into its own. For some reason, you know, Americans just love you know, the holiday season, you know, the Christmas season and all of that. So in a lot of cities in America, the Nutcracker Ballet became very institutionalized. You go almost any city in the United States and you'll see the Nutcracker Ballet being performed during the holiday seasons. And, you know, it's got beautiful dances in it, like the Waltz of the Flowers, very long dance, the snow scenes, very beautiful. You know, they have the battle scene with the mice, the Nutcracker fighting the Mouse King, you know, to protect Clara, and, you know, all the big battles that go on with that. And then, you know, in the second act is, you know, Fantasy Candyland, where they'll see Spanish dancers, an Arabian dancer, you know, Chinese, let's see, the Russian Trepec dancer dances. And of course, we have the big Grand Pas de Deux, the Cherplum Fairy Pas de Deux with her cavalier, which is a beautiful Pas de Deux in the ballet tradition. And it's just a wonderful ballet. You know, people come see it year after year, and they really enjoy it.
Great. And can you tell us again how we might be able to see one of these performances?
Well, we're going to have performances this weekend, Friday, December 5th at 7 p.m., Saturday, December 6th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. There's two shows on Saturday, and then one show, Sunday matinee on December 7th at 2 p.m. And this is all at Juno Douglas High School Auditorium downtown. Tickets are available online at thejack.org or at Hearthside Books or at the door. Adults, it's $20. Seniors, $15. Students, youth, and UAS students are $15. And there's a group discount of 10% for four or more tickets. And you can call Juno Dance Theater at 463-5327, LEAP. Or you can also go to our website, www.junodance.org. And get information about the performances there.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. You're with Kayla Deroche, and we have our special guests, Dr. Aaron Wolf and Jim Clark. Can you introduce yourselves, please?
My name is Jim Clark. I'm the president of the Juno World Affairs Council, which is a non-profit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to bringing speakers on international matters to Juno. And tonight we have Dr. Aaron Wolf speaking to us at 5 o'clock in the 360 North Studios, and we invite everyone to come. It's a free event, and we're looking forward very much to hearing Dr. Wolf's talk.
Okay, and Dr. Wolf, what will you be talking about?
So I teach at Oregon State University in the College of Earth, Ocean, Atmospheric Sciences, and we have a program there in water conflict management and transformation. So what I work on are when river systems or water systems are shared by two or more countries or states or political entities, there's often some disparate views about how to manage that water. And so I'll be talking about water conflicts and how they've been resolved around the world.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with resolving these conflicts?
Well, we don't say resolve, we say manage, because it's one step at a time. And I think the probably the closest one that I've been dealing with is on the Columbia Basin between the U.S. and Canada. And our floodwaters are stored in Canada, and we collectively generate a lot of hydropower, and that treaty's up for renewal. So this is one of the issues I've been dealing with. Close to home. But around the world, this is an issue of contention. Ethiopia wants to build a dam, and Egypt's a little concerned about it. And that's the kind of setting that happens around the world.
Okay. And so what would you say to tempt people to go to this talk? What will people learn and benefit from it?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think one of the more interesting things, people who share water include people like Israelis and Arabs and Indians and Pakistanis and even Oregon and California, and people who have real enmities. And somehow they're all able to manage these issues, even in the face of real conflict, even in the face of sometimes war. Water's so critical that it really brings people together, and I think learning a little bit about how that happens is useful for its own sake, but also to think a little bit more about what's really at the root of some of our world's conflicts.
Okay, and can you tell me some of that? You mentioned a conflict regarding Oregon and California. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, sure. On the Klamath Basin, we share a basin, Oregon and California, and it's a pretty typical lower 48 issue. It's their rights to the tribes there, to irrigation, to the endangered species, and all of those rights conflict with each other, especially when the water availability has been dropping, as it has been. And about 10 years ago, things got pretty tense. There was some violence and a lot of political tension. And over the 10 years, there have been amazing negotiations to where now everybody's getting along. The drought now is actually worse than it was 10 years ago, but somehow we're able to make it through simply because community knows each other better, has worked together, and has been real creative in trying to figure out how to resolve the issues.
And who are some of the players in these issues? Who do you work with to discuss this and... What was the word you used? Not resolve.
Manage. It depends on where I am. If it's within the U.S., oftentimes I've worked a lot with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. They manage the western U.S.'s water. And oftentimes in managing those facilities, they bring together stakeholders. So I've worked a lot with them. Internationally, it's with UN agencies or with the State Department or a lot of these basins have river basin organizations that are set up to manage their river collaboratively. And I'll work with those river basin organizations, the Mekong, for example.
And what other countries have you worked in?
I'd have to sit down and count. I've worked in some... 30 basins, I want to say, and that would be close to 100 countries.
Wow. Yeah. Well, how do you cross the language borders that might pop up when you enter other countries and you you enter their affairs?
Well, fortunately for me, a lot of the basins have, countries in the basin don't share a language, and so they'll default to English as their language of diplomacy. But I've worked in Central Asia in the Caucasus, for example, and we had simultaneous interpretation. It makes it a little slower, a little more interesting, but we're able to figure it out.
And what is that simultaneous interpretation?
In that place, it was those two basins. It was in Russian.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you say one incident that really stands out in your mind? Is there one case you had that really stands out in your history?
We have to come to the talk and find out.
All right. And can you tell me more about the council?
Well, the council has been working here for a number of years, and we now have formed a partnership with K2 so that not only are our programs broadcast from the studio downstairs, which has been a real nice venue for our events, it also plays, I think, on 270 public TV stations around the state. So we are trying to get good, strong exposure for our speakers and for our international program.
All right, great. Thank you so much for joining me. And when can we see this lecture?
5 o'clock tonight in the 360 North studio downstairs.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Of all the bird species driven to extinction in recorded history, at least 90% have been island dwellers. And amongst them, possibly the most famous, is the dodo. Nearly 400 years ago, on the island of Mauritius, Portuguese sailors were the first Europeans to lay eyes on this odd, flightless bird. The stocky gray-blue dodo weighed up to 45 pounds, walked on short, thick legs, and sliced open tough-skinned fallen fruit with an enormous hooked bill. Ornithologists have since learned that the dodo was descended from pigeons similar to the ground-dwelling tooth-billed pigeons of present-day Samoa in the South Pacific. Its song is unknown. By the early 1600s, Dutch sailors were provisioning their ships on Mauritius, slaughtering dodos as fast as they could find them. Hunting, together with the introduction of pigs and monkeys to the island, meant the flightless, ground-nesting dodo's days were numbered. By 1690, the dodo was extinct. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for this program comes from the Native Craft Co-op, located in downtown Juneau in the Senate Building, offering locally made and handmade Native craft, including beads, t-shirts, custom orders, and more. More information at facebook.com/nativecraftcoop.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Kayla DeRoche. I'm here with Peter Metcalf and Kathy
Goldhurst. Ready?
Right. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
So, you've written a book. Can you tell me the title of that book?
It is A Dangerous Idea, The Alaska Native Brotherhood and the Struggle for Indigenous Rights.
Okay. And can you summarize what it's about?
Well, it's about how the Alaska Native Brotherhood first conceptualized Aboriginal rights in Alaska and then protected it during a very perilous phase of American history, which was right when the Alaska Statehood Act was being considered by Congress.
Okay, and the title is A Dangerous Idea. So can you tell me what that idea was?
Well, Kathy explains that well.
The dangerous idea is suing your own government when you've only been citizens for 5 years. Citizenship was extended to Native people throughout the country in 1924. Before that, they were not citizens. And then in 1929, at this momentous Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood Convention up in Haines, group voted to sue the government for land lost and land use lost.
Okay, and you both worked on this book together. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it was really a rewarding experience for me because as a writer, you're usually by yourself. And with Kathy on board on this project, we were able to discuss, debate. You know, we rarely, never had really a disagreement, I would say, other than just passionate beliefs, well talked out, and it just helped a lot, and especially because the subject matter was a little bit new to me, you know, the Aboriginal rights and how that all came about.
And I'm an attorney, so I was able to give legal analysis that I think was useful, and then we debated and argued and tried to make sure that it was clear so that the reader would understand these complicated concepts and then understand this story that really I don't think has been told well.
Okay, and are either of you Native?
No, neither of us are Native, but we definitely had help and inspiration from our Native friends, including, and most importantly, Andy Hope, who was part of, who inspired us to get involved in this and was the reason we wrote a grant. But then Andy died of aggressive cancer a few weeks after we got the grant. And so in his spirit, we've been carrying on. And, his son, Ishmael, has contributed some very insightful results of his research that were included in the book, among others.
Okay, and can you tell me a little bit more about the Alaska Native Brotherhood and its history?
Sure. It was formed in 1912 by a group of Alaska Natives who had attended Sheldon Jackson, what was then the Sitka Industrial School. And they were inspired by, I think, their education that led them to believe they would become citizens of the United States as long as they worked hard and put their traditional culture behind them and were good Christians. Well, that didn't come about, and they took it into their own hands to win their rights. And so the background history of this book is what the ANB did in its formative years to conceptualize those rights, which were not recognized at all by the prevailing authorities at the time, and then to push those and win citizenship, win the right to vote, right to a fair education, health service. All these rights we take for granted were not available to them until the ANB and the Alaska Native Sisterhood made that happen.
And how did the Alaska Native Brotherhood build its voice over the years from its founding to present day?
Well, let me jump in on that one. The original title of our book was Sword and Shield, The Sword and Shield, and there was a KGB release book that prevented our using that title. But the sword of litigation was what the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood did, particularly in two cases, one an enormous saga over 40 years. So that's the sword of litigation. And then the shield was of committee room defense in the halls of Congress. Aboriginal rights were almost extinguished without compensation. It was very close. And that's why we show in this book that without the Alaska Native Brotherhood, it's highly likely that there would never have been a settlement. Their ANCSA could not have existed without this epic struggle.
So we're really proud of the fact that this is essentially new history, which is almost an oxymoron, but because this activity of accomplishments of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood had not previously been recognized. And the book was published by University of Alaska Press, vetted by several historians, and prior to that, we had it vetted by several experts on the history of Alaska. And while we got some corrections, nobody attacked the central premise that without the Alaska Native Brotherhood, there would have been very likely no Aboriginal rights to settle, consequently no Sea Alaska, no Gold Belt, no 200 other ANCSA corporations that are contributing very importantly to Alaska's economy to the present day.
What are some of the elements that made the Brotherhood so effective in representing Native rights?
Well, for one thing, they were very articulate, well-educated, and they were Native Americans. And when they were in Congress, and you know, as early as 1922, they sent a representative to Congress to fight the fish traps, which is a whole other issue. But William Paul was representing the Alaska Native Brotherhood in Congress in 1922 on that issue. And he was the first Native lawyer, the first Native legislator. He mobilized a Native vote by very clever means and became a very hated and despised individual by the white establishment. They feared him, which was a good thing, because William Paul was able to accomplish a lot by leveraging that animosity, actually.
He was a fierce writer. He would write an insane number of letters with 8 carbon copies behind them, and he did not give up.
All right. The book is A Dangerous Idea by Peter Metcalf with Kathy Rudy. Ruddy.
Mm-hmm. Ruddy.
All right. Thank
and
you
we'll
so
be
much.
The
signing
book signing is Friday.
Right. Great. At the Hearthside Books downtown Juneau during Gallery Walk. And so we really hope people will stop by, buy a copy, and we'd be happy to sign it.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juneau Afternoon, and you're with Kayla DeRoche, your host. That was the House Jacks for the Jazz and Classics concert on January 8th. And I have with me here in the studio the band, 2 band members from Susu and the Prophets. Welcome.
Hi. Hi. Thank
can
you.
You introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Riley Whitford.
I'm Mike Moss.
All right. So can you describe your band for me?
Yeah. We're a 5-piece cover band. Our lead singer is Shona Osterhout. And Riley and I, and Simon Taylor on bass, and Austin Osterhout on drums.
Okay. Simon and our drummer and our singer just got married.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, congratulations.
We're still getting used to the name thing.
Yeah.
So what kind of music do you cover?
Everything from the 60s up to present-day pop and rock.
Okay, and you'll be performing when?
Well, we're throwing a dance party after First Friday. So we start at 7:30 at the Rockwell Ballroom Friday night, the 5th. And we'll go probably till 11 or so. Just give people an opportunity to come shake their tails after First Friday.
It's all ages. So, you know, it's a restaurant, so you can have all ages event. There will be alcohol downstairs, so people can go downstairs and get a drink if they want and bring it upstairs to the ballroom. And everybody's invited. It's Mike's 40th birthday.
Yeah.
So we kind of wanted to have a big birthday bash to celebrate his 40th birthday and invite everybody.
And you have a cake planned, or is that...
No. In fact, I hadn't planned mentioning that, but, you know. That's
right. Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
All right. That's on the downline.
It's a big deal to me.
Everyone forget that. It was not spoken.
No, it's fine.
So can you tell me a little bit about your musical backgrounds and where you're from?
Sure. You want to go first?
Yeah. I started playing acoustic guitar 30 years ago and, you know, played all through college and stuff and played electric guitar and banjo for a while in a bluegrass band, and played in a country western band for 15 years, the Bob Family Band. And then we started playing about 3 years ago, and Shona wanted to it came together actually through the Diva mm-hmm. thing, and we were doing Heart and Adele and rock, you know, just straight rock and roll, modern rock and classic rock, and she's kind of got a soft spot for British rock because her mom's British, and so yeah, we just everybody said rather than do what a lot of bands do, which is like, well, I know this song and I know this song and I'll teach it to you. We all said, what song do you really want to learn? It's like, I've always wanted to do Boston More Than a Feeling or whatever, and we just started learning it. We spent probably 8 months before we even performed because mm-hmm. we wanted to learn at least 25 songs to start with, and then we started playing out and adding more songs.
Yeah, yeah. I've been playing piano since I was 7, and I picked up the guitar a few years ago, and I met Simon, our bass player, when I did Hedwig and the Angry Inch at Perseverance Theater back in 2005, and he and I have been tight ever since, doing lots of musical projects together, and then we're kind of a super group, really. We all have our own projects that we do elsewhere, and then we all got together for this band. And yeah, after the Divas thing, Riley and Shona were like, hey, this is great, let's keep doing it, and we were like, yeah.
Yeah, Shona and I had been playing in a duo, and we liked it. We came together with this five-piece rock band and thought, this is great, let's do that. So, and Shona, of course, is a director. You know, she's an actor and a director and is doing Chicago right now. And so everybody has kind of their other projects. Simon plays in Playboy's Basement. And
mm-hmm. Austin plays with the Deer Brothers and some other bands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we all sing. So it's great. We get five-part harmony, but basically.
We have a couple songs where all five of us are singing. That's one of the cool things about the band is we got five singers and five songwriters, too. So.
Yeah. And Mike goes back and forth between keyboards and electric guitar, and I go between acoustic and electric guitar.
We have a pretty eclectic set. We all kind of bring our favorite songs to the table. I have my 80s pop, you know, I like 80s pop, even some 80s hair metal kind of stuff. And then Riley's got kind of the little bit more classic rock angle, right? And anyway, we all bring our favorite songs, and we, like he said, we brought songs that cover bands don't usually do, and we're able to do them because, you know, we got the skills.
Can you explain the name Susu and the Prophets?
I cannot explain the name. Go ahead, Russ.
We rejected probably 50 names. Nobody could agree on a name, and that's the thing with five people, you know. And so it was our first gig. It was a showcase at Gold Town, you know, the KXL showcase thing, and we had to pick a name. And so I think Shona made it up on the spot. But there's actually a website, a band name website, and you just type in one word, and it will give you like 5 or 10 band names based on that word. So you type in the word like bear, and it'll say like Bear and the Bearcat Gobblers or whatever. It just kind of riffs on it. And so I was pulling tons of names out of that, and nobody liked them. And everybody had a reason why they would reject something. So I don't know. You know, I think a name like, you know, Pink Floyd or the Grateful Dead sounds ridiculous the first time you hear it, but you hear a name often enough, and then it gets to sound normal. And so, I wish we could come up with just, you know, the most awesome name, but...
Yeah, it's not easy.
It's not easy. None of us get to name ourselves, really. So I guess that's what happens.
You could always do a makeover, do a regroup.
We could.
I suppose. we've grown to like it.
Yeah, yeah.
Grows on you,
so hopefully this is a chance to hear us, though. You know, it's Friday night. It's Pay As You Can. So if you want to just pop in and listen for 15 minutes or an hour or whatever.
Or bring the whole family. You don't have to worry about paying for all of them kind of thing.
Yep, exactly.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks. Thanks Kayla and Jeff. Thank you.
This is Juno Afternoon with our host, Kayla DeRoche, and I'm here with a familiar face.
Hi, Kayla.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Christy Chambor. I'm the development director here at KTOO, and we're having an auction.
All right. Awesome. What are you auctioning? What's
the special item? Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to noon, that's December 6th, we will be live on the air from 8 a.m. to noon with some fabulous auction items. We've had some wonderful participation from the community. Right now, you can't see it, but I'm wearing a sassy apron. It is very sassy. This is an auction item from Nine Patch Treasures, and you can currently see the catalog at ktoo.org. There's a button there. You just click it. It'll take you to all of the auction items.
And just to describe this apron, it has a lot of patterns on it. Spirals, there's some plaid there, turquoise. I kind of want to wear it myself.
Yes. Odette is like an amazing quilter, and these are some of the fabrics left over from her quilting stash. So it's pretty cool. She also makes the hot out-of-the-oven rhubarb pies that are up for auction. So those you can bid for them, and then she'll deliver them warm on Monday to the station at 4 o'clock, which is pretty cool. And we have, just a great variety of things. We've got gift certificates for a lot of restaurants here in town, V Cellar Door, Tracy's King Crab Shack, which is open this winter. Also Salt, Saffron, Douglas Cafe, Island Pub, you name it, it's in there. So lots of things.
And so what's the process? Like, what do I do if I want to bid for something?
So you can pre-bid online right now. You can go to ktoo.org, press that button, register, and then you can go ahead and pre-bid for any items you're interested in. And then on Saturday, we start bidding with the highest online bid. And we go 2 minutes per item. That's it. It's like a real auction. Going once, going twice, and then you get gonged. And that's it.
So it's like once per hour, or like what's the window of time for the auction?
So it'll go straight through from 8 to noon. So if you can follow along on the auction catalog online, we also have hard copies here at the station. You're welcome to stop by and pick some up. I've got a ton. Or come to the studio the day of. We love to have people in off the street kind of to be a part of the action. And we have a little breakfast and coffee. It's fun.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And so what other items might I be able to bid on?
Oh, we've got a little vacation over to Gustavus, a two-night stay at Annie Mae with some tickets from Wings. We've got, lots of things. Aroma Touch treatment from Mountainside Wellness. Just lots of goodies.
All right. And again, this is through Saturday, right?
Yep, Saturday, 8 to noon on KTOO and KRNN. Listen in for the live broadcast.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Weather tonight, increasing clouds, patchy fog, and lows 25 to 31.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay.